Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Today, we're spending the hour with award-winning filmmaker and environmental activist Josh Fox, best known for his Oscar-nominated documentary Gasland, which focused on the environmental and health impacts of fracking. Josh Fox's new film, now streaming on HBO, is called The Welcome Table. It explores one of the most defining questions of our time. As governments build walls and criminalize people displaced by climate disasters, what does it mean to welcome those forced to leave everything behind? The UN says 200 million to 2 billion people will be displaced by the climate crisis by 2050. Everyone will be affected, but communities with fewer resources and those least responsible for the crisis will be hit the hardest. Displacement is already happening around the globe. In the film, people who have been displaced by the climate crisis have been invited to the welcome table on the Bywater Levee in New Orleans to share their stories. The people who join the table share stories about the deadly fires that claimed the lives of 85 people in Paradise, California, torrential rains and landslides in São Sebastião, Brazil, droughts in Kenya, the legacy of colonialism in Australia, oil companies destroying lives in the Peruvian Amazon, and more. The Welcome Table takes us face to face with people experiencing the brunt of the climate crisis. Here is the trailer for The Welcome Table.
Well, I wanna see this beautiful city.
We're about to take part in the greatest mass migration in human history. People from every continent have been displaced by climate change.
So this was actually the main part of the house. Most of it was Irma, and then Maria took the rest.
The climate is changing beyond anything manageable.
The people at this table, people from all over the world, crossed many rivers to get here.
During the fire, when we got gridlocked, we were all stuck.
Could hear the propane tank starting to blow up.
Just thinking, it's not how I go. Just brought a baby into this world.
Governments know this is coming, but they aren't building aid stations and immigration centers.
They're building walls and detention centers.
These people's stories need to be told.
All of us out in the boat capsized, and most of them could not make it. So I saved this boy, and this boy in return saved me.
Where is home now?
What will it be like when we get there?
Where will we be safe?
Will we be welcome?
I'm so proud to sit here and listen to your story. That's what unity is about.
We have to heal the planet. We have to be the medicine.
We invite you to our table. Sit with us and hear our stories.
Sit at the welcome table. See that beautiful city. One of these days. One of these days.
The beautiful voice you hear there is jazz singer John Boutte. He sings songs in the film and is one of the narrators. That is the trailer for The Welcome Table. You can watch it now on HBO. We are so happy to have Josh Fox join us. He's director of The Welcome Table. Josh and his team spent years making this incredible film. Josh Fox is an independent filmmaker and founder and artistic director of the International WOW Company, a film and theater company creating work that address national and global environmental, social, and political crises. Josh Fox's debut film, Gasland, earned a special jury prize at Sundance and an Oscar nomination. His new documentary is called The Welcome Table. Hi, Josh. Thank you so much to you and your team for this really important documentary, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, here we are, Josh, and we've got these devastating fires happening in France and Spain. More than 300,000 people have been displaced. The Guardian reports that at least one person has died in Valencia, Spain. And then we saw the fires in Canada. They're still raging, and there's fires happening in Oregon right now. I know that you have been affected by the smoke.
The fires are raging all over the world, not just in North America, but in South America and in Europe and in Africa and in Australia. It's beyond imagination, but these are the things that climate scientists and journalists have been predicting for decades, and we're seeing it happening now. And yeah, in New York City, we were blanketed by climate change fire smoke. I try not to call them wildfires because that's a decidedly 20th century term. These are climate fires or climate infernos. And they're not ordinary fires. Nobody's ever fought fires in conditions that are this hot and this dry. In the New York Times, they mentioned that there was a fire cloud in France, just some kind of bizarre thing that creates more and more fire. And they neglected to use the word climate change in their article at all. So we're seeing a kind of not only this planet burning and being on fire, but a reluctance in the media to actually call it what it is, which is a climate emergency that's getting worse and worse and will continue to get worse for a very long time. And that is something that we will have to grapple with. And that's what the film addresses. You know,
it's interesting to hear you say that you don't use the term wildfire, that you use climate inferno. Can you talk about the importance of language here? Because something I've been hearing that's making me uncomfortable is human caused climate change, as if all of us humans are responsible for this equally. I think the fossil fuel industry probably loves that term.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think for a long time there was a campaign on behalf of the scientific community to call this man-made climate change, to distinguish it from something natural, some natural phenomenon that was occurring, not due to any of the human processes. But as we go forward, we see that this is really, really misappropriating blame for this on the human race. And there was a study that just came out that said, you know, the top 10% of people who have money in this world are causing something like 70% or 80% of climate emissions. So this is a question of economic injustice. This is a question of power. This is a question of politics. And I get asked the question, so it's not human-caused climate change. It's billionaire-caused climate change. It's fossil fuel-caused climate change. It's extractive capitalism-caused climate change. Those are the, and it's, and in terms of the way we view it in the welcome table, it's a consequence of empire and colonialism that's been going on for hundreds of years. Fossil fuels and the way that they're handled in our society is really a symptom of a system that has gone completely out of control that rewards a Nazi like Elon Musk, who's doing Nazi salutes at Republican conventions with $1 trillion and has made very incredibly harsh economic inequality all over the world. That is the system that is causing climate change. And what's on the horizon is, the AI and the data centers, which are going to engender, I mean, I think what they would like is to supply those data centers with fossil fuel-based energy, and that's going to cause a huge new explosion in fracking and all sorts of other fossil fuel, extractive techniques, and accelerate climate change even further. It's almost as if they think we have another planet somehow to go to after this one is destroyed, because it's getting destroyed rather rapidly. And it's extremely scary and troubling, and it's the backdrop for this film. I think it should be the backdrop of every conversation in our lives right now. I think to eliminate climate change from any discussion, whether that's political or cultural or emotional, spiritual, any of those, is somehow ignoring the elephant in the room at this point. We have to be including it in everything. So this film, yes, includes climate change. It is about those headline statistics that you just mentioned, but it is a story that I think exists on an entirely other level. And that is something I'd love to talk about. But you're absolutely right. Human change, climate. I mean, you know, indigenous cultures throughout this world, and we visit quite a few in the movie, in the Amazon or in Australia or in Africa, are by and large not causing climate change, but they're suffering the worst impacts. The system of that, you know, creates billionaires, that rewards wealth, astronomical wealth and economic inequality, that is what is causing climate change, and that is what has to be fought, and that is what has to be addressed.
So why don't you elaborate on that? You and your team did an amazing job of really connecting the dots. As you say, the welcome table is obviously about climate migration and the crisis, but you also connect the dots to empire, to colonialism. And at a time when people are fleeing for basic safety, governments around the world are investing in walls, incarceration, in what they call border security. So can you talk about the thinking that went on in this film and how you all thought about connecting these dots.
Well, that's quite a question. I think there's two answers to it. There's a sort of practical answer from the standpoint of journalism and storytelling and world history, and then there's a kind of internal answer that I would love to give. But basically, in 2019, when Trump started the policy at the border in El Paso of basically kidnapping children, they called it the child separation policy, and taking children away from their parents or their guardians, I was so outraged because, you know, my father was a displaced person. He was an infant survivor of the Holocaust. He had been separated from his parents quite a lot, and that was a through line that ran through our family. So I went down to El Paso, and I interviewed a number of people, and one of the asylum seekers who had crossed the border into Texas, her legal right by the human rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, to cross a border and declare asylum and say that I'm in a place that's unsafe. Her two siblings, ages 4 and 12, were taken from her and just disappeared into the system. And she had no information as to where they went, and they could have been anywhere in the country. They could have been in El Paso or New York or Houston or anywhere that there's a detention facility. And as far as I know, never found them. And there are currently like 20,000 children who have been taken from their parents across this country. That's an act of child abuse. It's obviously a human rights violation. It's a crime against humanity. And I realized that there was another part of this crisis that was going to push the migration issues into the stratosphere, which is climate change. I have been obsessed with climate change migration for a very long time, realizing that as cities burn and get flooded or fall into drought, or we see these enormous cataclysmic events caused by climate change, that people are going to not be able to be safe at home anymore, and that they will migrate. And then looking into the statistics, you know, there's a lot of different ranges, anywhere from 1.2 billion to 3 billion people having to move because the places they live are no longer safe and habitable and hospitable and temperate. That's a staggering statistic. It's a staggering idea. It's the largest mass migration coming soon and happening now in human history. And I do believe that the xenophobes, the racists, the authoritarians in government, whether that's in the United States or in Europe or wherever, understand this. And I think that's part of the reason why they're doubling down on these incredibly harsh policies of militarization, of incarceration. And my first thought was, how can they even possibly think of incarcerating a billion people? And then, you know, wanting very much to think about the wall, not just the southern border wall, but walls all over the world, because there are biometric walls in Haiti and in Thailand and all these borders all over the world, as a metaphor, not as an effective technique, because certainly all you need is a ladder to get over the wall. In this country, we needed to give $200 billion to ICE just to get these policies to start working, to create the largest police force, the most well-funded standing army, apart from the United States Army, in the world, to start to try to enforce what is obviously an aberration in human nature. So I started thinking about the wall as a metaphor. And that, you know, it's almost like, you know, Donald Trump had never listened to Pink Floyd or whatever, that the wall was probably not a good idea. But I wanted to know, what is the opposite of a wall? What is the opposite of this hatred and xenophobia? Is there anything that can be stronger than those forces that are gripping the world at this moment? And, you know, I for me, a movie is an investigation. It has to be a question that I don't have an answer to. And the idea of the table came about when I was talking with Dr. Cornel West, actually, on a Bernie Sanders campaign event. And I told him I was thinking about making this table at the border, a long, long table across, you know, 1,000 feet on the border. People from both sides of the border could come. And he said, you know, James Baldwin's last book was called The Welcome Table. And it's with the estate, he never finished it. And I just thought, The Welcome Table, this is an amazing idea, concept. Where does it come from? And then I was in New Orleans, and I saw John Boutte, and he has this song called The Welcome Table. And I thought, oh my God, this is this is a sort of weird, mysterious kismet that starts happening as a journalist when you lean into something. You start to see these connections, you start to move it almost as if you're following a mysterious thread. And I talk about that in the film. So on the one hand, you have this, you know, political and ideological historical analysis of that I want to tell as a historian, as a journalist. But then on a personal level, just weird things just kept happening that I had to follow. I had to find out. I had to find this through line from, you know, the folks in Paradise, California, who were running for their lives with their children in their arms, to the Virgin Islands, where they had had double Category 5 storms hit them inside of 2 weeks. And then that, following that sort of mysterious thread, pulls me all across the world and creates what is really an ensemble storytelling. The folks in the film who come to the table at the end of the process in New Orleans, that go all over the world, tell their stories, tape their stories, and follow their narratives. And then we invited all of them that we could to this single table in New Orleans where they met each other. And that group of people from all over the world with different economic backgrounds and different sexual orientation, different race, became a community instantaneously and then told their stories to each other. And that process is the narration of the film. They narrate the film together. It's a group and an ensemble telling. And that strange emotional thread that is some part of the mystery of what it is to be on this planet, it kind of pulls us through the film. And that's something that I feel like I have faith in. And that what we don't have a lot of when we encounter this overwhelm of authoritarianism and climate is basic faith that as a species we'll be able to figure this out. And that's what I wanted to try to encourage with this film.
The Welcome Table, it's beautiful and devastating. And as you say, the people from different continents come together to share their stories around this table in New Orleans, asking, where is home now? They sat and talked for about 5 days about what they've been through.
Yeah. Together, and became like a very tight-knit group. Because this, you know, when we think about climate change, I take a lesson from our work on fracking. When we made Gasland, I showed a person or several people lighting their water on fire out of the tap of their sink, and that image sort of defined what fracking was. It was polluting groundwater, and so much so that you could light your water on fire right out of the tap. And I think what helped so much with the movement to stop fracking, which has been very, very successful in a lot of places. I'm in the Delaware River Basin now with the New York City watershed for 16 million people. We stopped fracking here. It never got fracked. We saved this place. And that, you know, I believe that a lot of it had to do with the fact that most everybody has a kitchen sink. And they were able to look at the kitchen sink and go, hey, you know, that's kind of just like my kitchen sink. And the random kid 12-year-olds all over the country were trying to light their water on fire, even though they weren't in fracking areas. And they would come up to me and tell me, I tried to do this, you know. It occurred to me that nobody really has a climate. You know, you can't look at a climate and be, oh, that's just like my climate at home, you know. It's not really, it's so ethereal, it's so huge, it's almost impossible to grasp in your mind. But everybody has a home, I hope. Or a place where they come from, or a table, you know? And we have to kind of pull this down to the very simple things. So this idea of where is home on a planet that's collapsing, on a planet that's making so many people have to move, you know, we're either going to be moving ourselves out of fleeing from some climate catastrophe, or we're going to be on the receiving end of quite a lot of people that we have to learn how to welcome. And from 30 years of international collaboration with my company, which started in Thailand as you know, 20-year-olds and out and making theater, I understand that welcoming people from different cultures is an incredibly complex and difficult process that takes a lot of endurance and a lot of patience just to figure out what people are saying to each other, because the word, you know, love might mean different things in Japan as it does in Germany, as it does in France, as it does in Texas or whatever. And those things have to be interpreted, and it takes an enormous amount of generosity. But the one thing that we have on our side is when people get together with that mission to try to understand each other, there's this incredible burst of generosity and love, and that we can become our best selves. Rebecca Solnit talks about this in her book, A Paradise Built in Hell, this idea that hellish circumstances can create the best in people, the most generosity, the most tight-knit connections. And that, I think, we have to think about and count on as we navigate the most intense period of change that human beings have ever navigated in our history. So that's, you know, the internal motivation and what I witnessed happen. I knew from 30 years experience that this was going to happen, and I watched it happen, and we recorded those meetings up on the levee, and we had New Orleans musicians come and sing to them and welcome them. And then of course that was the idea that we have to get very good at welcoming, and this is sort of a blueprint for how to do so.
And Josh, you have been, like you say, you've been at this for a long time. Gasland came out in 2010. How long have you been working on climate issues?
Well, you know, I've been in the theater and in film and storytelling my whole life. Since I was, I think I made my first movie when I was 6 years old, you know, and it was a stop motion animation Dracula movie. But I mean, so I've been doing storytelling for a very long time, and my lineage is with storytellers. My grandfather was a poet and in music as well. And so I don't really think about that I'm making, like, about 15 years ago when I started making Gasland, I shifted my focus from what was at that time really thinking about the Iraq War, and as a survivor of 9/11 and a resident of New York City, and you know, working on those issues, the fracking industry came to my backyard, and it became an emergency. And that film that I made for like $5,000 in the back of an old beat up, you know, Toyota Camry, driving around the country, sleeping on the side of the road, sleeping on people's couches. That film got picked up, you know, it was at Sundance, and it got picked up by HBO, and it was nominated for the Oscar, it won the Emmy, and it was seen by hundreds of millions of people all over the world. And then it kind of catapulted me into a place where I was talking about the environment, which of course is something very, very deep and important to me, having sort of grown up in the woods. You know, I felt that was a responsibility and obligation to continue that story. And I do think, so I moved from being a narrative playwright and filmmaker to a documentary filmmaker. And the subject in many cases is the climate and the environment. But I don't think about that as any way limiting, because that is an infinite topic, an infinite subject, because my films are really about human beings and great stories and, you know, tragedy and love and endurance and survival and great character. I mean, Gasland was a movie that asked the question, does America have the character to fight back against the oil industry and the gas industry? And lo and behold, absolutely, that American character really came through in a beautiful way. And in this movie, it's about, in terms of terminology, I don't like thinking about the word refugee, although it's an important legal distinction. I think of these people as survivors, as climate survivors. I think of them as, you know, human beings who've had this incredible traumatic story and who have seen the hell that's on the horizon and come back to tell the tale. And, you know, that's the survivor's obligation to both tell us where we are now and to warn us about the future. And so those are very powerful stories. But I think of this as a movie, weirdly enough, as a comedy, not as a tragedy. I think most climate movies are tragedies, like a tragedy and comedy. These are the two great forms of storytelling. Tragedy is where everybody dies at the end, and comedy is where everybody gets married at the end, you know. And so I think of this end of the film as a very symbolic marriage. Nobody actually got married, but we were hoping somebody might, just because of immigration laws, maybe. But nobody did actually get married. But the whole community kind of gets married in that end, and it's this incredible explosion of joy. So I think about it as a great Shakespearean comedy, like As You Like It or The Tempest, where the lovers are tossed across borders into the forest. They have no idea where they're going, what they're doing. Midsummer Night's Dream is very much the same. They have these transformative experiences, and they come out the other side in a much stronger and healthier bond with everything redefined: nation, character, emotion, love. And that is the story of this film. So, you know, that's how I thought about it the whole way through, as a comedy that we were going through all of the trials and tribulations that people in those great plays go through, and then we are going to come out the other side. And I really hope that somehow that attitude can change our viewpoint on a lot of this and re-energize a movement to actually get our planet back together.
Well, before we go to break, the fires in Paradise, you interview Allie and her partner, and they're at the table, and they talk about how when those horrific fires happened in 2018, there was no official public warning. They just heard explosions. And obviously, luckily, they got out with their baby. And Josh, it was just so devastating to learn that Allie, her partner, and her baby are now living 30 miles down the road in an RV in Chico. So a lot of the people in Paradise who lost everything are still displaced.
We're not prepared. We're not prepared for what's here at all. I was just talking to a mother, a friend of mine, whose child was at camp in Michigan. And it was clear that the camp in Michigan was experiencing the worst air quality on the planet Earth because of the fires. And these kids didn't have masks. Mm. They didn't have a place where there was filtered air to go inside. They're sleeping in bunks. And I thought of all the children at camps across Pennsylvania and New York and Ohio, all the places that were experiencing this incredibly toxic air, and that these camps were not prepared. And that the parents of should be calling these camps saying, why aren't you prepared for climate change? And in the same way, you know, more people died in New York City from Hurricane Ida than did in New Orleans, because New York got hit and all these basement apartments flooded, and the people were not prepared and they drowned. And people are on the highway in on the BQE getting their cars drowning. And so we're not prepared mentally. We're not being prepared by the media. We're not being prepared by our politicians, by and large. Interestingly enough, Zoran Mamdani, the mayor of New York City, did come out and say, look, we've got to really prepare for these fires. We've got to really prepare for climate that's coming. And in building infrastructure to try to protect New York City. But I hear very, very little of that. Mm. Because I think to a great degree, I think a lot of the climate campaigners think, well, if we say it's too late, then people are going to check out and go, oh, well, we can't fix this, so whatever. But that, I think, is wrong. I think we have to fight for every single degree that we can keep the planet cooler, and we have to figure out how to do that by stopping, first of all, methane, which is coming from the natural frack gas industry into the atmosphere. That is actually one of the things that's accelerating the climate crisis the most, in the most aggressive manner, is methane and fracking, and we have to address that first, and then obviously CO2 and decarbonizing our economies. But we know now that we're going to be facing really, really, we already are. Look at the planet, it's on fire. And are people prepared for this? No. Are societies mentally preparing for this? People are telling you to have a go bag. Like, oh, you should have a go bag for 72 hours worth of change of clothes, whatever. Like, this is that our plan for the future? Really? And then, you know, people ask me all the time, where will I be safe? What can I do to fight climate change? Well, where will I be safe? There is really no geographical answer. We heard for a long time, oh, move to Wisconsin or Michigan. Well, here, lo and behold, we have these children in camp that are breathing air quality that's 500 AQI or way worse, because 500 is where the scale stops, right? It's the top of the thermometer. They don't know how much worse it was than that. So there is no geographical answer. There's no place that you can escape to get away from the climate crisis. The only thing we have is our communities. We have to build strong communities. We have to have preparedness. We have to have bucket brigades. We have to have an understanding of who our neighbors are. And that political struggle unites people. Here in the Upper Delaware River Basin, I know all of my neighbors, and I can walk down the street and talk to everybody, because we had this immense fight against the fracking industry, and everybody had to pull together and learn from each other and work together. And, you know, it created this incredibly strong community. And the truth of this struggle is that it's not about changing your light bulb. Yes, okay, do those things, you know, lower your own personal carbon output or whatever. Those are not the issue, right? Anything we can do on a personal level is not the issue. Spend 95% of your time changing your politician and 5% of your time changing your light bulb. And what I mean by that is that this is a struggle very clearly against the 1%, against the billionaire class. They are driving the climate crisis. This is a crisis of ideology, of economics. It is a political struggle. And those people, just like Elon Musk is to blame for killing millions of people by killing U.S. aid, those are the people who are driving the climate crisis, and they have to be, the steering wheel has to be taken away. There should be no billionaires. Every billionaire is a moral failure. It's a policy failure. It's a human failure. There should be no wealth inequality to that great degree. We have to address that not just as a nation and as a system, but as a world.
On today's Your Calls One Planet series, we're spending the hour with award-winning filmmaker and environmental activist Josh Fox, best known for his 2010 Oscar-nominated documentary Gasland, who is out with a new film streaming now on HBO called The Welcome Table. It is a really beautiful film. The footage is just incredible. It explores such an important question. As governments build walls and criminalize people displaced by climate disasters, What does it mean to welcome those forced to leave everything behind? The UN says 200 million to possibly 2 billion people will be displaced by the climate crisis by the year 2050. Josh Fox has been at this for many, many years. If you have any questions for him about where we are now, about his work, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call's One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are spending the hour with award-winning filmmaker Josh Fox. We're talking about his new documentary, The Welcome Table. It is streaming now on HBO. Josh and his team spent years making this film. The Welcome Table explores such an important question. What does home mean? What does it mean to welcome those forced to leave everything behind? In the film, people who have been displaced have been invited to a welcome table in New Orleans to share their stories. In 2024, more than 45 million weather-related disaster displacements were recorded globally. This is the highest figure since the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center started tracking data back in 2008. Josh, we grabbed a number of clips from the film, and you and your team did such an amazing job traveling the world and introducing us to incredible people. So I want to make sure we have time to really elevate their voices. So you went to the Calabrian coast in Italy in 2023, and we meet Delphine and her son, Prince. You and your team share stories about people leaving Africa for Europe because of climate disasters. And Delphine says, there was nothing to eat. Where I'm from in Africa, the heat alone will kill you. We were a group of pregnant women and children. We climbed into an inflatable raft. There were 70 people on the boat. And luckily, Delphine survived. So here is a clip about that issue from The Welcome Table.
Imagine getting on what's essentially a raft with dozens of other people and heading straight out towards the middle of the sea. The sea, so terrifying at night.
That blue, blue Mediterranean Sea. The EU is using the Mediterranean like a wall.
And like the wall, it's failed as a deterrent.
Nobody knows exactly how many migrants have drowned in the Mediterranean trying to reach Europe from Africa. It could be 40,000 people in the last decade, 4,000 or 5,000 a year. But there's no records of ships. There's no way to know.
Now imagine that you're floating out there, vulnerable, thousands of miles from home. No one knows where you are. You see a boat and it starts shooting at you.
They're shooting.
Yeah, they're shooting. Yeah.
The Italian government gave warships to Libya, and they're calling it the Libyan Coast Guard.
And they've been seen shooting at rafts full of migrants from Africa, deliberately trying to swamp their boats and drown the people.
So-called Libyan Coast Guard, what you do is very dangerous. Over.
This is international waters. Don't shoot us.
In spite of the heroic efforts of nonprofit organizations like SOS Mediterranean, the governments of Europe are allowing or encouraging the Mediterranean to become a mass grave for migrants.
That is a clip from the incredible new documentary, The Welcome Table. The other narrating voice you hear there is the jazz singer John Butte. Josh, this part of the film, I mean, the whole film is incredible, but this part of the film is just so devastating. As you tell the story, we learn that most of these bodies are never recovered. And for those that are, there is a place in Calabria. People from all ages, from all over the world, are at this, what kind of looks like a makeshift grave. At least 30,000 people have died since 2014, and it's not going to stop. You know, the other part that was just so Just incredible to watch is on Italian beaches. We see these people swimming in this beautiful water. And then we see young men from Pakistan and Bangladesh selling beachgoers blankets and trinkets. So these are people who made it there, and they're just selling things to try to find food and make ends meet.
Yeah. Well, the one person I interview on the beach, you know, my family is from Calabria, from southern Italy. My mother is from there. My father was a Jewish Holocaust survivor as an infant, but my mother is Italian, and her parents both migrated from Italy. And so I was in Calabria, visiting relatives, and I saw these guys on the beach in these incredible beach towns in Calabria, which is right across from Sicily. And they had like a whole Walmart on their back. You know, mm-hmm. They have these giant trays and there's like, flotation devices and beach blankets and pails and sunscreen and anything you might want on the beach. And they're just walking up and down, walking up and down, walking up and down, looking like these giant sea creatures almost. And I was obsessed with this image and interviewed one guy who is from Bangladesh, which is a country that is, a third of which is going underwater right now. And he was able to get to Italy, but has no papers. So he can't go home, and he has no way to go back and see his family after several years. And that's just one tiny little story in this film. And as we're seeing these SOS Mediterraneo, an incredible organization, and you heard some of their footage there as they're out there with one big boat. They coordinate with planes to find these rafts. There are rafts that take off from the coast of Libya, try to make it to a place called Lampedusa, which is this tiny little speck of an island that is owned, it's Italian, in the middle of the Mediterranean, or get rescued by a ship of some kind. And those boats are literally like giant rafts, and you see them in the film, and they're just, 170 people on them, and no captain, no navigation system, no way of knowing where they're going. And there is really no record of how many of those people have drowned in the Mediterranean. Their estimates are 30,000 people in the last decade, could be way more. SOS Mediterraneo goes up with a plane, they try to spot them, and then they direct their boat towards the raft and rescue the people. And Chris Obehi, a story in the movie, was on one of those rafts, and it did capsize as the boat was approaching, and he was one of the very few people who survived, because he had a young boy in his arms that he found on the boat that he had no parents, and he was chosen to get out of the boat first. He tells this very, very emotional story. And then Chris is a great musician, great, great songwriter, gets to Sicily, survives, and he becomes a famous songwriter who's adding this incredible musical soundtrack, not only to our movie, but to the streets of Palermo, and is touring all over Sicily and is an incredible voice for refugees, for migrants, and his stories in the film. So, every one of these people who, right now in the United States, we see footage of ICE wrestling people to the ground, abusing them, torturing them, throwing them in the backs of vans. These are nameless, faceless, quote unquote migrants, whatever you want to call them, that ICE and Trump and this new Gestapo is rounding up by the tens of thousands, by the millions, and throwing into these newfangled American concentration camps, where a lot of them actually have disappeared. I think there's I don't know what the exact number is, but thousands of people who have just disappeared from Alligator Alcatraz with no record. Nobody knows where they are. Their families are trying to find them. There's no idea where they are. And each one of those people is a human being with an incredibly compelling story. And we, part of the film is humanizing what this system right now under Trump and ICE is dehumanizing. A key component of fascism is to dehumanize immigrants, to dehumanize other races, to dehumanize and criminalize. And, these are folks with incredible stories and immense contributions to be made to any civilization that they choose to be in. And that is this movie. It's telling those stories of those people who right now in America, we don't know their stories. We don't know their names. We don't see their appeal. And that is the incredible injustice of what's happening in the United States. And also right now in Italy, where migrants are being, are criminalized and blamed for every single problem and not welcomed. We do go to one town where they do welcome people. Mimmo Lucano, a very famous mayor in this town called Riace, welcomed migrants, created a whole migrant economy, and that's where we meet Delphine. And, you know, he was prosecuted by the Italian government for breaking immigration laws by creating a thriving community in a town that was basically abandoned. A lot of these Calabrian towns where my relatives came from have very, very low population, tons and tons of empty, dilapidated buildings because there's no people because there was no work and people left and came to places like New York and San Francisco and New Orleans. All those Southern Italians that you will meet in America now, those places are, a lot of those places are ghost towns and could use migrants. So that's one very hopeful story in the film, the story of Riace. Yeah, so these tales are important to tell, and they're very, very gripping. And what you hear there is the narration tossed back and forth between myself and John Boutte. John Boutte, really we are co-musical directors of the film, and John Boutte himself, a displaced person after the levee failure in New Orleans after Katrina, wrote the Tremé theme song that's very popular of the Tremé theme TV show on HBO, and no longer lives in the Tremé because he was forced out. So it's a lot of these stories, but the film takes a kind of jazz approach or hip-hop approach to the narration, and everyone in the film tosses those narrations back and forth, and it creates this symphony of different voices, which I think is really an innovation and was the key to understanding how best to tell this story.
We're speaking today with Josh Fox, director of the new documentary, The Welcome Table, which you can watch now on HBO. It is streaming. It's really a beautiful film. So many stories in here, Josh. Just again about Riace in Calabria. It was amazing to see that when this mayor welcomed in immigrants, they fixed up homes, the community was reborn. It became a beautiful community again, as you say in the film. They took the fear of immigrants and turned it into love. Do you have any updates on this mayor? Because he was facing 14 years in jail for taking this
move. When we got to Riace, yeah, he was accused of illegal misappropriation of government funds or something like that because his town didn't have enough children to have the government fund the schools. So he took in migrants who obviously needed a place to live and to be in a new home and made their quotas. But then he was prosecuted for that, as if, you know, giving a place for migrants was a step too far. He was acquitted eventually, and we do mention that in the credits of the film that he's acquitted. But he still could not get a visa to come to the table in New Orleans because the Italian government prohibited him from traveling, even though he is a member of European Parliament. He was elected to European Parliament. So there's always a way for those authoritarian governments to try to take away your right to move. We all have a right to move. It's delineated in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We go into this in the film. But Mimmo Lucano luckily did not spend the rest of his life in jail due to essentially racist policies in Italy. He was unable to come to the table and unable to travel to the United States. And we were never really given an adequate explanation as to why. He could not attend the table. But Chris Obehi does come to our table and tells those very dramatic stories. Delphine is another person without any status. No work permit, no official status, no visa. So we could not get her to the table in New Orleans as much as we wanted to. And at the end of the film, we go through all the people who are in the movie who could not get a visa to come to our very, very unique gathering, a gathering that was created by the film and by HBO. If there isn't any more legitimate reason to bring somebody to the United States, it's a movie that's going to be on HBO. And we still could not get paperwork for quite a lot of the people in the film. And it was a tragic occurrence. And so I hope to bring the film and the table all across the world and show the film in Riace. We have some invitations from Italy, from Brazil, from a lot of places all over the world. And, you know, spoiler alert, at the end of the movie, movie, we built the table 1,000 feet long and invited the entire city of New Orleans to come demonstrate a kind of a symbolic moment of joy and defiance and celebration of migrants. And that 1,000-foot long table is a symbol of basically the opposite of the wall. A wall on its side can be a table, and we want to take that table all over the country. We're trying to raise money right now to do this tour. We want to bring the table to 10 cities in America, and to the Amazon, and to and to Calabria, and to Australia, all the places where the film goes. And because I think for the New Orleanians who participated in that final scene, and there are 1,000, that singing, dancing moment of standing at the table, sharing together, was a life-changing event. And I think that if we can bring that that symbol to people's minds, there will be an image, you know, much like the image of people lighting their water on fire with fracking, that can be an image that implants in people's mind that says, no, this is actually a better way forward.
Josh, just briefly, when you and your team went to Turkana, Kenya in 2022, if you can tell us about this, the original home of all of humanity, they've been dealing with a 6-year climate change-induced drought. The area no longer supports human life. We meet Purity Gakko. She works with Impact Kenya in the northern part of the country, and she introduces us to Arat. She and her family are the last in this area. Everyone else has migrated. I mean, this is almost like fiction. She says her neighbor migrated because of hunger. She said, you know, we had so much happiness here. We had the freedom not to worry where our food was coming from. Our parents could provide for us. Food was coming from the animals. We lived in harmony with them. And then I grew up and the world changed. All of the animals died off. She said, I'm now having trouble sleeping. Where will I find food for my kids? There is no rain. The rivers have run dry. Arat relies on a single well, but it's obviously not enough. Can you talk more about what it was like to meet Arat and learn about what's happening in Turkana, Kenya?
Well, Impact Kenya is one of our organizational producing sponsors. We have all these different organizations involved in the film, Amazon Watch, Impact Kenya, I mentioned SOS Mediterranean. And so, you know, there was a survey done of climate refugees by an organization called Climate Refugees and Impact Kenya together. And I went, I was able to sort of tag along. And the most outspoken people from that sort of survey, one of which was Arat, and another for Turkana, you know, friends, I don't know, from a neighboring town named Lodoyo, and they were just incredibly passionate about speaking about what was going on. Arat does her entire interview with her baby strapped to her back underneath her garment. You can't even see it. And, you know, for me, the thing about this that frames it in the film is that everyone on Earth is a migrant. We've all come from somewhere else. If you go back far enough, sometimes you only have to go back one or two generations, right? Like with myself or Donald Trump, you have to go back two generations. His grandfather was German. And, you know, visiting with Arat was, these are the only people in the film who are not migrants. They are the original people. They are where, you know, Homo sapiens emerged from. And you can watch that group of folks coming out of Turkana and going first all the way down to Australia and where they found the Aboriginal tribes and the culture there, and then up to the Middle East, and then over to Europe, and then across the land bridge, across Asia to the Americas, you know, North America, South America. And that is the migration of the species across the planet. But the original people come from Turkana, and the incredibly horrifying irony is that climate change has impacted those regions, even though they caused none of it. They don't burn oil or coal or gas. They don't contribute to emissions. But there is no rain. There has been no rain in Turkana for years and years, and that meant their cattle could not graze. These are pastoralists who live off of the animals, the camels, the goats, the cows. And the migrating herds, the herds of cows had to migrate into other parts, into Uganda, where it was actually raining. And so a lot of these villages in the place, the original place of human beings, are mostly abandoned and have very, very few people left because there's no water and there's no food. So people are living in a condition that is, you know, day to day, they have no idea if they're going to survive. And many, many people, we visited many graves of people who had died of hunger. And so, you know, this film is 2 hours. It could have been, you know, a mini series of 6 hours or more, because of all of the stories. But Arot, who was an incredible person, has this unbelievable positivity about her. She created little sculptures of all of the animals that she was missing, the camels, the goats, the cows, and showed us these sculptures because this was her way of saying, like, this is what we used to have. And that's just an unbelievable place in the world, and the people, the style is so amazing. The clothes that they wear are incredible. And she said, you know, when we look at the stars, we think that that's our ancestors up there cooking. And she just gives me this little smile, and everything's being done through our great translator, Chris Achilo, who's working for another organization called Tupado, another great humanitarian organization in Turkana. And it just shows this unbelievable kindness of, like, hey, but we're going to just meet and talk. And I think that's my teacher, Ann Bogart, the great theater director, always used to say, we only have one choice at any given moment, which is to connect or not to connect. And, you know, that is our dilemma right now. We have to connect with each other. We have to connect the dots on climate change. We have to connect the dots on the billionaires that are making it happen. And we have to connect with each other past all of these cultural boundaries and racial and economic boundaries. And we can do it. And when we do that connection, something new is born. And that's what home will be in the future. That's what we have to create in the future.
Well, Josh, you and your team really did an incredible job on this film. We have so many other stories we'd like to share, so we hope that you'll come back. Josh Fox is director of The Welcome Table, a fantastic, incredible documentary that is streaming now on HBO. Find more information, klw.org, click news, and your call. Josh, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. And we will definitely have Josh back to continue this very important conversation. I really hope you can take the time to see The Welcome Table. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls One Planet series.
I'm Rebecca Kesby, host of BBC NewsHour. Today, the